Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hop-Ons Podcast, a podcast hosted by me, Colin Cox, and him, John Phelps.
All right, I think we got to have a better intro than just a podcast. Like a podcast about, I don't know, you're right, just a podcast. Colin, hello, good evening.
It's just a podcast. Hi, hello.
Colin is in his tank top.
Oh, yeah.
You look fit. You're looking swole. Did you get your pumps in today?
Yeah, I did about 25 push-ups before we started recording.
Did you? To get it out?
No, just...
To get it going?
Yeah.
You're wearing the sort of nondescript Nike hat. I've never been able to, like, do that. I have a friend that he only wears an Adidas hat all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, and maybe you can, like, speak to this... Why wear a hat that, like, is just a nondescript athletic company? You don't want to have something cool on your hat. I'm wearing this dope-ass New York Knicks hat, by the way. I know nothing about basketball.
That's a wonderful hat. So this hat specifically, I have to be careful. For anyone who is curious and wants to know, I can develop really bad headaches. I like wearing hats, but I need to be careful. And so, like, this hat in particular is one of these, like, flexible running hats. So it's really floppy. That's the only reason why I chose this hat.
I see.
But, like, so, like, I really like the hat that you have. And I have a couple of hats similar to that. I really can't wear them that often because if I do, something happens and I start to develop these awful headaches.
You have such a huge brain. Your brain is so big. Can we talk about, we're here to talk about Mission Impossible and other things.
Oh, yeah. The mostly Rolf Impossible. Saxton vehicle, Mission Impossible.
The Rolf Saxton classic, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. But Colin and I, this is something we've done the last three Mission Impossible movies. And the next 10 that Tom Cruise makes, his old ass, he can't just lay down. But I want to talk about your movie wearing outfit. Okay. So when we go to the movie, Colin is like dressed to the nine. He looks like Ethan Hunt is in disguise in like a French cafe. You had on this like sort of like newspaper boy hat.
Yeah.
Your glass, you had like a this perfectly like zipped like sweater thing going on.
Well, no, so it doesn't have a zipper. It's this like tan shacket that I have. It's like a, it's not quite a shirt, but it's not quite
jacket.
A jacket. It's like a shirt.
I didn't know there
jacket,
was a portmanteau shacket. Called of shacket.
Hey, I just made it.
Now,
yeah.
I like
language
that.
Is a
That's
living
great.
Thing. Yeah, it's a shacket. Yeah.
And you had like your bag, you legit looked like Ethan Hunt. Walking up to me, and I looked so frumpy. I had like my jeans rolled up like a hillbilly and my pink shoes on, and I was like,
"No, you look spectacular.
Let's go watch the movie."
You looked really spectacular in these excellent. They weren't New Balance tennis shoes, but they felt
the Asics,
similar to.
They were Asics,
but they weren't like a basic. Off-white, gray New Balance. They were these really beautiful, vibrant pinks. And I have to tell you, I noticed the cuffing because you hit it just right. The cuffing was perfect. Yeah.
That's a big deal. Anyway, no, we went and saw...
It's a big deal to me, because you can do one of two things. You can cuff it the way you did or just buy bigger, baggier pants. And you chose to cuff.
I have no time for that.
And I liked
it. Yeah, I don't... I'm not happy that the new, like, big, wide-leg pant... is making a return. I prefer the tight pant that shows off my thighs and my ball sack. I like that. I like that they feel hugged. You know what I mean? But now we're at a point where it's like these big baggy things. I spoke to my sister-in-law about this, and she said they fought for years to get the high-waisted baggy pants to come back in.
Yeah.
And I'm not like on the edge of fashion, so I don't know.
Yeah. No, this is something I've noticed. I've always worn tight or tighter jeans, but I must confess I've bought some like baggier jeans recently. I'm really enjoying this. I don't think I realized
I can't
how much
imagine
I would enjoy
you in a baggy pant.
Well, they're I think probably on a spectrum they still skew probably much closer to that tighter fit. but they're just in particular like baggier around maybe the waist and thighs, and so I like it. It's nice.
I know that everyone tuned in to hear our hot talk, our hot takes on.
Oh my God! I can't believe I forgot fashion. To mention this to you.
Oh, go ahead.
So a couple of years ago, I mentioned this idea that John and I could do a collaborative Halloween costume where he goes as Jon Snow and I go as Longclaw, and I basically just plank the whole time. I have another idea for a collaborative Halloween costume. Do you know the song "Leather and Lace"?
Leather and Lace?
Yeah.
Who's this by?
So this is a Stevie Nicks and Don Henley collaboration.
I will not be Don Henley. I refuse. I don't like the man in general. I don't like the Eagles that much. That's what you want, our collaborative?
I think if you listen to the song, you and I could do a collaborative Halloween costume where we're one of the two personas each from the song Leather and Lace. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can be Lace. That's fine. I can be Don Henley's leather.
I don't think anyone's going to get that. I mean, people might get that I'm Stevie Nicks. That's a very unique look. I would have like long laced cuffed arm sleeves and stuff. And big long hair.
We could just carry a fan around the whole time.
Yeah, but Don Henley is just a douchebag in like a leather jacket.
That's I think so. Yeah, although I would encourage you, go find photos of him from the 70s. Boy, oh boy, that Don Henley. Oh, yeah.
Was he as attractive as Don Johnson? Don Johnson's my preferred Don.
I don't know, Bob. We can talk about this later. Yeah. No. Don Henley was an attractive man in the '70s. That's
speaking of Don, real quick. Current events. Have you heard that people are calling Trump Don Taco now? Which is my new.
This
it's
is
the
my
best thing.
This is the best thing.
And he hates it, and I love
he
it so
he clearly
much.
He hates it. So for a guy who has, and this is to his credit, because I think this is one of his skills. A person who has found a way to create the silliest but most appropriate nicknames for his political enemies and just anyone he doesn't like. It's wonderful that his nickname, the one that has stuck, is Taco. It's just
the best. It's so good. Don Taco. I'm not a fucking taco.
So I'm not mad. A taco. If anything, I might be a Subway cold cut, but I'm not a taco. Everyone knows. I didn't come over the border. I was here before. Everyone knows. I'm not cold cut.
Don cold cut. I will not be shocked if he somehow tries to ban tacos from America. We want them off the shelf. No, nobody wants the taco shells.
We're putting a 300% tariff on tacos. We're calling it the taco tariff.
So I have a question for you. Do you think that because we watched Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, and we have been known to be a bit of a stands for Thomas Cruise.
Yeah,
Thomas A. Cruise. The A stands for
Thomas
Angelic.
Thomas, yeah, Thomas Angelic Cruise is his given name. Yeah,
His Christian name, Scientology name. Do you think that he's really mad that he did all this work and put all this effort in to have one of the most insane third acts of a movie only to get beaten by a Lilo and Stitch remake? Do you think that he like is really fucking bummed about it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know how much that matters. I genuinely don't know how much that matters to the actors. Now, I remember back in the day, there was this narrative about George Lucas wanting to make The Phantom Menace because he was annoyed that James Cameron's Titanic made more money than I think one of his Star Wars movies. I have the impression that it matters a lot maybe to someone like George Lucas, who's not just a director, but he operates and functions as like the author, the symbolic authority figure for that text. But I think Tom Cruise in a lot of ways does for Mission Impossible. He's not just the actor, but he seems to be the driving aesthetic force for these movies. He's the one who decides how they, and I know he probably works in collaboration with a lot of other people, but he's the one who seems to decide that, no, these movies will be this way. We will not gravitate towards CGI. So I don't know. And I know he's always been a producer. I think back even into the 90s with the original Mission Impossible, I think he was part of that production team. I genuinely don't know. But I think, John, that's one of my questions as a way of seamlessly transitioning away from taco tariffs into Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Who's this movie for? Because I think that's what I find really confounding. It's a movie that, and you and I think we're baffled by the pre-credit stinger, because it operates under the assumption that we remember nothing from the last movie.
Yeah,
and that that was a smart assumption, because I remembered nothing from the last movie. but it's not like these movies, they and you can see in this movie that the narrative tries to create this complex mythology, really centering the Ethan Hunt character as like the protagonist of this world. But unlike perhaps Star Wars or Marvel movies, there aren't all of these additional supplemental texts that help to maintain enthusiasm with the franchise. So I just don't know for whom this movie was made. I think that's the thing I find confusing. I think I think you and I both agree that this is a wonderful, fun movie that finds a way to make action sequences aesthetically satisfying, but I just don't know the audience. I don't know for whom this movie was made.
Yeah, that's a super good point. I have thought about that too, and I think the biggest issue with this movie is the plot. The plot is just so nonsensical. I mean, they use like the most insanely like ambiguous verbiage of the entity and the rabbit's foot. They go back to like the third Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah.
And they bring up like, that's a huge deal now in this one. I think the entity somehow opens up the rabbit's foot, which is like a code for like a computer. I mean, I don't know. It was wild. And, and a majority of the movie is spent doing a lot of remember this. But the thing is, like with Mission Impossible movies, and, you know, we're 35 years deep, so there's not a lot of people who are going to be like, yeah, I don't remember that, because, you know, it was 30 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the movie is made for people who are action fans. They definitely, and you and I openly laughed a lot at the dialogue, because they purposefully are making this movie for people that are just wanting to chomp on their popcorn and just go, hurry up and get to the... jump off a building. That's like the audience that this is for, because they spoon feed everything. There are lines that are just so laughable. At one point, Ethan Hunt does something huge, and in the cabinet, the Secretary of Defense or something looks at the president and goes, "Son of a bitch."
Yeah,
he actually did it. And I was like, man, that line has been, you never, that's a line that's used in a parody of a movie like this, and they just took that and threw it all together, but they did it in such a way that it was like, it was so tongue-in-cheek that we laughed at it. I mean, it was a good time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the movie lacks from just plot, but Tom Cruise is so watchable that I didn't really care. I mean, I think this movie's made for people that like the Mission Impossible series, that like action movies, and really just want to see probably the last true, like, A-list movie star do his thing for a couple hours.
Yeah, I think that it's, hell, maybe you could argue this movie was made for an audience of one, and that's Tom Cruise, it seems. But I think just to compliment what you said, and I think I said this when we spoke about the last one, that part of what makes these movies so engaging is not necessarily the movie as the primary text, but all of these paratextual elements. So like knowing that he was probably like submerged in water for an unnecessary amount of time. That, again, it's interesting because the movie as a text, it seems, cannot just exist independent of those paratextual elements to appreciate it. It feels like, and I think they understand this intimately because of how they deploy marketing material for this movie. To really appreciate this movie, you must have a sense of how it was produced, or at least you need to know some things about the production. And I don't remember what I said last time, whether I thought that was a good thing or a bad thing, but if people are becoming, if an audience is encouraged to investigate production standards, I think that's really interesting because I think that helps to enhance, like, cinematic literacy. I think
sure.
if, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but when I watch, for example, even if there's small documentaries about the production of one of these Marvel movies, and I just see them all standing in front of green screens, it feels really boring at that
yeah.
point.
Yeah,
and,
no, I
and,
agree. Yeah.
And I think, like, if you can see that, oh, so, like, Tom Cruise is quite literally flying a motorcycle off a cliff. Like, he's yeah. doing that. I don't know. I wonder if that's a good thing. I think maybe, again, I don't remember what I said a couple of years ago, but I think I'm now persuaded that this is a good thing, that it's encouraging people to think about how we make movies. And that was part of, like, before the movie begins, Tom Cruise addresses the audience directly, and he
yeah,
speaks to the way this movie was produced and how they wanted people to watch it. And so I think all of that is really interesting to me because it's clear that he has obvious anxieties and frustrations about modern movie making sensibilities and audience consumption sensibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's great. I totally agree with that. I think, I always compare these movies to Jackie Chan movies because Jackie Chan was like, Jackie Chan walked so Tom Cruise could run sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Jackie Chan is like, if you haven't seen 1980s to like early, probably like mid 90s Jackie Chan movies, this guy is doing the most insane shit imaginable. And one of my favorite parts about his films is like, after the movie's over, as the credits roll, they always show like a blooper reel, quote unquote, where things just go awry. And that always made me really like it because I'm like, oh, they're actually, imagine how much craft is behind this. Like the amount of choreography, the amount of set design, the amount of production, the amount of spiking, everything. It's got to be perfect so that we don't kill somebody sort of thing. And you know, Jackie Chan has done stuff like he skydived out of an airplane onto a hot air balloon and like rappelled down it. Like he does crazy shit like that, you know. And so I watched that and immediately think, Tom Cruise has to have seen that for inspiration, along with other things like your Buster Keaton stuff and your Charlie Chaplin stuff. But
oh,
I think
we talked about the train sequence as like that
sure.
feels like heavily inspired by Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think he just is a person who he's been in the industry so long, like he just sees what practical things can do versus the feel of these sort of mm-hmm. green screen big bombastic yeah. battle sequences. I mean, nothing against them. Like, it's fun to watch a big comic book movie and point out your favorite characters and all that, but, like, you feel this movie. Like, they're the action set pieces in this, specifically the underwater one, is 10 times better than anything the Marvel
beautiful.
Movies have ever
And it's beautiful.
Done.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it
it's,
is.
It's,
yeah.
It's genuinely beautiful. I mean, there is one funny line that you and I
this so is dumb. Yeah.
Ribbons on an air conditioner. But
yeah.
I think, and that's really the thing. If I were to encourage people to invest time in these movies, it would be for that very reason, John, that you watch these movies, and again, maybe it requires some paratextual engagement, but the way action is rendered so beautifully, in the way action and editing and practical movement helps to tell a story. They're these little, like, almost contained vignettes within
yeah,
this
yeah, yeah.
much larger narrative, which I think, not that I've really cared that much. I mean, we like David Lynch, so we don't care that much about narrative coherency.
Sure.
But I watch a movie like this, and I think, in the same way that I look at a play like Hamlet, and I think, sure, there's an overarching narrative, but the best way to understand Hamlet is to see it as a collection of potentially disconnected scenes. Shakespeare really cared about the scene. He seemingly cared less about the bigger, broader narrative. And that's what this movie feels like. It's like, what if we made really interesting 20-minute action sequences? But Tom, we need to make a movie, though. I mean, well, that's fine. Just throw a story together about an AI robot. We'll call it The Entity. It's fine. Whatever. Who cares? And we saw the same thing in the last movie, like that car chase sequence. That's one of the most captivating car chase sequences I've seen in a really long time with Hayley Atwell. I think she was part of that sequence.
She was, yeah.
Yeah. Just
no,
yeah.
That's a good point. Because when we walked out, I said, this is every 90s action movie rolled into one, because that's what it feels like. And I think I've always wanted to like write a book on 90s action movies because I'm so fascinated by them, because they are just this plot. The way that those movies would work is like the plot was nothing. It was, I have this idea for like six action set pieces. I need a backbone to lay them on. And now I need a star to put in, you know. Like, apart from the ones that are, like, the top dogs, like your diehards and your predators, most of them were, you know, by the book. Like, a Steven Seagal movie would be, shows up here, there's bad guys hurting someone, I beat up those bad guys, they want revenge on me, yada, 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 I beat everybody up in the end, and that's how it goes. That's sort of, like, the vibe of 90s movies. This is what Mission Impossible is getting to, is the plot is so nonsensical that who cares about it? We're just ramping up to this next big action sequence. And, you know, we have to have something to try to hang our hat on to get there. And that's more for, like, the critical thinker mind, which if you're going into this with that sort of expectation, why are you doing that? You know, I that's not what this movie's for. You know?
Well, again, I think if you, I mean, CinemaSins could do a sins count on Hamlet because of all the narrative inconsistencies. But sure. Again, that wasn't Shakespeare's concern, really. Again, think of scenes as like episodes or like vignettes or these little short films that's all contained within this larger thing that has the, you know, nominal trappings of a plot, but it's pretty messy. And I was thinking about a movie like The Rock, for example, where it's,
oh yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's like, what do we want this movie to be? Soldiers occupy Alcatraz. Why? One of them is mad about a thing. Okay, and then so what do we do? They need to break in and stop them. Who? What's Nick Cage doing? And Sean Connery. Sure. Let's get them to break in. Let's do it. Yeah, I can build like dope action sequences around that premise.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah,
exactly.
Let's do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this movie suffers from, much like, I love The Rock, by the way. We should do a Rock episode sometime. I love that fucking movie. But the other Mission Impossibles, apart from 3, like 4, 5, and 6, and 7, leading up to this, they all had, you know, a sort of against the clock sort of thing, but they all were really fun. They all had this like, you rooted for everybody on screen. They all had in jokes. They all laughed and smiled. There were scenes that were like meant to be funny, you know. And this one, I think, they didn't have any of that. This one was just a heavy, heavy movie. Even like when they meet Dunlow from the very first Mission Impossible movie.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
Which is amazing. He's so fucking good in this, by the way. He like steals
He's
the
really
thing.
Good.
Even when they meet him, like they don't even tongue in cheek that. It's just like this very somber, you know. Well, yeah. But when you think about like what they did to Dunlop, they gave the guy terrible fucking diarrhea, so he had to run out of the room so that Ethan could steal the knock list. Like that's how they get him out.
Yep.
They don't ever bring that up. And in my brain, I thought that would actually make this movie. A little bit of brevity and it would have been nice or something like.
Well, they do mention it at one point, don't they? When he says, "You don't need to apologize. It was the best thing that ever happened to me."
Right, but they don't say like, "Sorry, I gave you terrible diarrhea." Oh. Like, give me like some type of levity, like some type of joke that's
okay,
like,
fair. Yeah, yeah.
Let's just have a laugh about something, because it's not even Benji, who is particularly the funny man, played by Simon Pegg. The only time he's like got any type of joke is at the end when he's been shot. He He doesn't die.
Yeah, spoiler. No, this is a humorless the only time film in a lot of ways.
It
yeah.
is, and I think yeah. that versus the last movie, which was just full of humor, and it had, like, scenes. Most of these movies have a scene where they do something, like, in a big crowded area, like an airport or, like, at a party. I love when they do, like, the big theater or dinner party heist that they've done those before. This one didn't have that. This one was a very somber, to-the-point film. So, yeah, I think that that's a big gripe I have also. It's just it's not really, like, fun, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's... From what I recall, so many of these movies have these apocalyptic or potentially apocalyptic consequences, but it often feels contained. So, and when I mean contained, I simply mean, like... This is not a global, you know, phenomenon or consideration, but it very much is in this movie. I think this movie feels like in the past it was always like Ethan and like five other people knew that something horrific could happen, but like everyone else was just living their lives.
That's a great point. Yeah,
I don't know. Like this feels like the literal end of the world, and so I wonder if that maybe influences the sensibilities a little bit.
Yeah, it's so dumb, man. Like it's very heavy, but they're like, the entity has taken over all the nukes of Russia, and they have like a board that they like shows like a ticking thing. They have a big board, and I wanted to lean over to you and be like, she's gonna see the big board.
They're gonna see the big board. Yeah, no, I was thinking the same thing.
But it was so silly.
Where is George C. Scott right now? Because he would be terrified at the number of people who could see the big board.
If we had that, and when I saw Nick Offerman from you, Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, yeah. He's like the Secretary of Defense. And when I saw him, I was like, okay, that's my George C. Scott. That's going to be my point in the movie where
he
could be like a really silly, insane bastard and turn this whole thing around. No, he doesn't do that. They don't do that.
No, everyone has that stiff upper lip because, again, I think unlike previous movies, and it just happens so quickly. It's like a month after the last movie, and it's like, well, the apocalypse is about to happen. Now
yeah.
I will say this. In the same way that like Darth Sidious is kind of a funny character in Revenge of the Sith, I think the villain in this movie is hilarious. And I think like he goes full ham, and I think it's really funny a lot.
Yeah, we have to talk about how he dies because
dude,
it got a genuine laugh from me. And it was the only part in the movie where I out loud laughed because he's been this unbeatable villain for Ethan. Yeah. He's always one step ahead. You know, in the last movie he kills one of Ethan's crew.
Yeah, does it in this movie too?
Does it in this movie too? Yeah. Kills somebody in this movie too. And you're like, "Oh my god, you know, this guy's unbeatable." And then he just dies by He gets bonked on the head real good and falls out of a plane.
It's the best.
Literally, they could have put in like the pipes dropping sound effect when he hit his head, bonk, and then it. That's all that happens, and then he falls.
Yeah,
out of
he
plane.
Had like he had like Tweety birds circling around his
that's
head.
That's genuinely
you know?
How yeah. I thought that's all we got, guys.
Yeah.
This is a huge set piece where you've flown on a plane for 30 minutes, and this is. All right. They got tired. Even the scene was tired. The scene was like, just kill this fucking guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there is something satisfying about that choice. Also, like Ethan breaks his arm in a
brutal
graphic.
Brutal.
Way. Dude, his performance is so funny. His hurt acting, this rivals Pierce Brosnan in the Bond films as like the silliest hurt acting I've ever seen. It's spectacular. So like I was laughing when he did that. But I think there is something satisfying about like, as you said, this Herculean, unstoppable villain. He doesn't get the triumphant death. It's just, bonk on the head. There you go.
Yeah.
And then you just like... Yeah. Tumbles out of the sky, you know? It was, yeah. Even that was the few moments of levity seem to happen when the villain's on screen because he is Darth Sidious level silliness in this movie.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
All the scenery. There's nothing left. He's just chomping all of it.
Yeah, he's chewing it up. It's just, the movie is, and again, I really liked it. I mean, I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd solely because of the big set pieces.
Oh, I gave that, it 4 stars too. Look at that, twins.
Did you? We 4-starred it. The underwater set and the biplanes are just they're amazing. But the movie's 3 hours long, and really it could have been a really solid two. Yeah. Because there's so much exposition that is just so boring and so silly, and you know what's going to happen. And I think that is what really, really is the most upsetting, is how, like, telegraphed the whole film is from beginning to end. I mean, there's a moment when, before the biplane scene, the villain loudly is like, "I have a biplane. I even brought an extra one that I'm not going to need. They can't be hit by the entity because they're all analog, baby. I'm glad it's weird I have an extra plane." Yeah. I was like, okay, well, I wonder who's going to take the extra plane.
Yeah, who's taking the extra plane? Here's my Letterboxd review. I give this movie 4 out of 5 hosta lasagnas. Don't get any anyas. It gets 4 of those. So. I thought you'd like
that. I mean,
oh, I also,
if you like Mission Impossible movies, go watch it.
Bub, I think you'll like this.
Oh, go ahead.
I rewatched Rogue One. Beautiful movie.
Now that's a flick.
Beautiful movie.
Now that's a movie right there. I'll tell you this much.
3.5.
I love that.
Stars.
I love that. I'm looking. I have a poster of that on my wall.
Yeah.
Wait. What? Hold on. You gave Rogue One 3.5 stars?
Yeah, I think that's
And you
really
gave
good.
Mission Impossible 4 stars?
Yeah, my star system doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
that doesn't make any sense. Rogue One is a better movie.
I give Rogue One 3.5 sad Mads Mikkelsens out of 5. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Have you seen Andor? Did you watch Andor?
I don't know what this is. Yeah, I just rewatched. Oh. I'll be frank with you. I just rewatched Rogue One because I remember you saying how beautiful it was, and like it has some pretty obvious problems.
Yeah,
but yeah, I thought, like, again, just ignore the story, guys. Who cares? And just watch, like, beautiful filmmaking. There's a moment when they break the 180 degree rule in a perfect way. It's really beautiful. It's a really subtle little thing when, like, the two main characters are arguing about, like, their motivations. Anyway, no, it's just, like, the craft of that movie I thought was really, really solid.
It is. You should watch Andor. Andor's the prequel to Rogue One about Cassian Andor. The Diego Luna, the guy with the goatee in Rogue One. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I got you.
That's like the best piece of Star Wars media that's ever. But again, I think Star Wars should never have been made into the big thing. You give me the first three. Those are fantastic. Dump the other things. Dump them in the trash can. I'm so sick of this Grogu. You see, you heard about this guy, this little fucking dude?
Oh, is he the Yoda guy?
He's the little Yoda, yeah.
Sorry, I thought you were about to do your Jay Leno. Yeah, I heard about this Grogu.
You heard about that? Yeah. Heard about Grogu? This guy can't even fit in a spaceship the right way.
Yeah, he doesn't even talk. Yeah.
Can we talk
hope
really not, quickly about
hope he's not
your
paid
obsession
by the lines of dialogue? Yeah.
It's very good.
Not like me. I get good. Not like me. I get it, in my contract. I get paid by the weight. Yeah.
Oh man! Imagine an in-universe fucking Jay Leno within the Star Wars universe. Hmm.
Yeah. Man, did you hear about the Anakin Skywalker?
I don't have to hear my wife's voice anymore.
Yeah, did you hear about that Anakin Skywalker? Yeah. If you just don't want kids, you don't have to kill all the younglings. Yeah.
He's hanging out at Jabba's palace performing. Before, in between the dancer routines, he gets up, does a tight five.
Yeah,
I fed my wife to the Rancor last week.
Han Solo was getting so upset. I said, "Han, chill out." Yeah.
That would have killed, honestly. If I had been at that club, I'd have been the voluntary one of those laughs.
Yeah.
That'd have been sick, dude. God,
yeah,
that
we got a great
really
show tonight.
Good,
Boba Fett is here, so stick around. Yeah. We've been doing this for 5 minutes. I gotta stop. Sorry. Okay.
You could do it. I think you could do it forever. It's very good. He has the head bob and everything down.
Yeah.
Have you seen the video of Tom Cruise eating popcorn?
No.
You have got to watch this. It's fucking insane the way this man chows down. He gets a tub. He said he eats like two giant tubs of popcorn. Every movie. He's like, I love popcorn. I can't stop. I love popcorn. But he like takes it and he like chucks it in his mouth. He like throws it in his fucking face. He doesn't like put it in his mouth. He literally is throwing it. He's like, nah, nah, nah. He's doing like. It's enough like people recorded it and said, only Tom Cruise could eat popcorn this way.
He has a giant mouth though. So, yeah.
I noticed that. I thought I would notice his age more. I don't.
Mm-mm.
I don't.
No.
The guy is he's a fucking mutant, is what he is. He's made some pact with whatever they believe in, the Scientology people. Whatever they are. Don't they believe
aliens
or something?
Yeah, there's a weird sequence where he's like running in his underwear, and I think now this guy doesn't need to do any running. He's good. This is like his thing. But it was clearly just a sequence where Tom Cruise can show everyone, I'm 60, but I still got it.
Yeah, look at me in these fucking little black panties that I have on.
I was
Tom, trust me. That was a funny sequence, though. When the guy's stabbing him and he's like, oh, come on. Like, can't even get my workout in without
can't
this
even,
dingleberry.
I know. Yeah, get off the internet, kids. Yeah.
No, oh, that was a great made a little incel joke. That was good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I enjoyed that. I think so. Yeah, I mean, this is a movie, as, I don't know, most of these Mission Impossible, maybe someone's written about the politics of Mission Impossible, but they feel often, maybe not apolitical, but the politics of these movies feels indecipherable at times. But this movie seems a lot clearer that, like, AI's bad. The internet radicalizes men. Stop it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the true message of the film. I think, and it suffers from, apart from the first one, these movies are so wildly forgettable.
Yeah.
But the first one was directed by like a really good filmmaker.
Yeah, De Palma, right? Yeah. And I remember, I know the second one isn't that good, but I think it's an interesting, again, like the filmmaking of that movie, I think is really interesting.
Memorable. John Woo directed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It came out at the most perfect time.
Perfect.
For him to be like that badass version of Ethan Hunt. And
which
the badass
is strange.
I use
with
big sort of air quotes around it.
Yeah.
And I remember... distinctly when I watched that movie like four times in theaters. I remember at the beginning when he's rock climbing and they shoot a rocket onto the top of the mountain he's on and it has Oakley sunglasses in it. And the sunglasses come out and he puts the sunglasses on and they were like, you're a tough man to find. And he's like, I didn't want to be found. And then he takes his sunglasses off and he throws them at the screen and it blows up into the logo.
Yep, I remember. Yeah,
and it was the dopest shit I had ever seen.
And
I think
a Limp Bizkit song.
It was
played
Limp
over
Bizkit
the opening.
Did the opening?
Yeah. Yeah,
and then the actual Mission Impossible theme was recorded by Metallica.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay,
it was awesome. See, it was fucking great. It was like if you wanted to see like what would MTV look like as a movie, it's Mission Impossible 2.
That's really good. I mean, because like they're all I cannot remember the name of the villain. I think it's like Townsend maybe is the actor's name.
Some Irish guy, I don't know.
Yeah, but they basically it's frighteningly similar to GoldenEye as a movie. Like he's a former MI6 agent who went rogue. And he has this whole thing throughout where he's like, I need to get my gun off. And like, he's like, he like wants to like shoot Ethan Hunt a lot. And like, there's that sequence when he does that, but it's the guy, you know, it's like his main hench buddy. And Ethan like puts the mask on him, and then he somehow has a mask of that guy, just like in his bag, I guess.
Yeah. They mask it up a lot.
They mask it up a lot.
The famous where they jump motorcycles at each other and they catch each other in midair, and then doves fly all over the goddamn place.
Oh, if you remember, Ethan kicks the gun up in the air that was in the sand and then grabs it and like does a sideways thing and shoots
him. Oh my God, dude. Core memory unlocked. I for sure did that on my bed multiple times.
I know you did. Yeah, I know you did. So do you know why Thandie Newton is in that movie?
No, oh, I forgot she was in that. She's the main...
Yeah, she's the love interest.
Was she ever a Bond girl? Was she a Bond girl?
No, she wasn't a Bond girl. She was in Interview with the Vampire. And I think like Cruise was really impressed. And so I think he wanted her for Mission Impossible.
Jesus Christ. I mean, the Interview with the Vampire had to have been a while before that one, right?
Like 94, maybe 95?
Because, I think MI2 was 2002, I think, right?
2001, I think it was 2001. So hold on, I can go ahead and tell you.
It has to be pre-9/11.
Okay, Mission Impossible 2 was 2000. Interview with the Vampire was 94, so it was like 6 years. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when they flirt.
Crazy, right?
Yeah. Via like car, they car flirt.
They car
flirt. Like fuck with cars, but they like do spin as you fucking do with cars.
Yeah, they did the spin thing. Yeah, as you do.
That's how I met Melanie. I
tell people this story. No one believes me that you were that she was stealing a necklace.
Yeah.
From like a Mexican drug lord, and you were there to stop her. Yeah.
It wasn't a Mexican drug lord. It was just an antique shop in Abingdon. She stole it, and I caught up to her in my 1998 Volvo.
Yeah, she was in a Corolla. Like you two were just spinning.
She was in a Corolla, and we tried to do a J turn, and my whole fucking transmission fell out.
Yeah,
she had to take me to Walmart. It's the hillbilly Mission Impossible. I got to break in here. They got my grandpapa's pipe up in this antique store. Oh, I got to get it back. I'm putting a crew together, and he goes He gets his buddy who blew his hands off with fireworks. Mm-hmm. That's my demo expert. That's Jeff.
I don't know if I told you this. I didn't know this until years later. Do you remember? I'll find the name of the actor. Vladimir. Is it Vladimir? It's the doctor, Dr. Vladimir. I can't say his last name because it's Russian.
Sure,
and I
Dr.
can't
Vladimir.
It.
Yeah.
John, for many years, I thought that was just Tom Cruise in makeup.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Which movie is that in, too?
It's in two, yeah. The doctor who injects himself.
He was played by Tom Cruise at one point.
Well, I think at one point they do the mask thing, of course.
I don't think it was a full mask. I think they gave him like a fake nose or something.
Okay, is that what I'm remembering? Because I, for the longest time, thought that is not a real actor. For some reason, Tom Cruise just wanted to do a Russian accent. And so it's Tom Cruise as this Russian doctor. That's what I thought for the longest time.
He thought he watched Nutty Professor, where Eddie Murphy was the clumps. And he's like, here's a crazy idea, guys. What if I'm just everybody in this one? And they were like, you get one Russian. And he's like, that sounds great.
Yeah. Okay, I guess I'll call Thandie and tell her that she can be the love interest. I was prepared to do blackface, guys. But I guess that's fine. We could just hire someone
blackface.
Else.
You could have put, love it, guys. It was right before he went fucking nuts.
So maybe this is the last thing we can say. If you had asked me about Tom Cruise's career, I would have said at some point in the mid-aughts, he basically became an action star because that was like the only thing he could do and his career was just bad. That is not true, actually. For some reason, this is crazy. So in the mid-aughts, because again, this is when I thought he just transitioned to being an action star. from 2003 to 2007, The Last Samurai, Collateral, War of the Worlds, Mission Impossible 3, Lions and Lambs, and then Tropic Thunder in 2008. And then I guess he just decided, like, I'll just do action movies now. It wasn't by necessity, it seems. He had made some really cool movies that were not strictly action films.
He did Magnolia, too, right? Like right before that.
That would have been 99. Yeah, that was 99.
Oh, 99, okay.
Yeah, yeah, but and no, this
he,
is like...
He had done Jerry Maguire, too, right, at that point?
96, yeah.
Okay, okay, yeah, so I get, yeah, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's a, his career is super interesting.
Yeah, because War of the Worlds is not even really, I mean, it's an action movie, but he's not doing action things in it.
No, I mean,
he's
it's running a Spielberg a lot, flick, basically. Yeah. Yeah, and like... There's action in The Last Samurai, but it's not action in the way the Mission Impossible movies are. There's some action in Collateral as well, but again, it's not, it's different. But these are also like really like interesting, beautiful movies as well, and they're not just strictly action films. But yeah, no, I had just thought that like he had kind of, you know, become a washed up movie star a little bit and just like pivoted to action. But I guess that's not the case. He just decided to start making action movies.
Now, you forgot he was in the third Austin Powers movie.
Yeah, that's listed here in 2002. Yeah, baby. Yeah. Yeah. So.
He played Austin Powers. People that were not, like, high schoolers during that time or, like, early college, you're missing out. The Austin Powers time was a wild time to be alive. That era of, like, those movies and, like, MTV culture... Yeah. Is the wildest shit you could possibly imagine.
Crazy. Yeah. Yeah. It's the first, I mean, they become increasingly silly to the point that I'm not even sure how funny they are. I mean, John Travolta as Goldmember is pretty funny. But the first God, Austin Powers, that, yeah. Yeah, is a genuinely funny, funny movie. It's really, really funny.
Is it that I watched it recently and I wasn't like,
oh, we talked about this, that you were not that impressed. Yeah.
I did. There are a couple gags really got me. When he gets stuck in the hallway in the golf cart is always funny. When he has to do like a 1,000-point turn, always fucking funny. When he takes the super long piss, I don't know why that's so funny when they unfreeze him and he takes the longest piss ever, but it makes me laugh so much. I can't help it.
I thought the monologue during the family therapy session was really funny because I think it ends with the line, if you've never seen a shorn scrotum, you really should. It's quite spectacular. And then Carrie Fisher says, okay, we need to stop.
Oh, I forgot she's in that. What a movie.
He says the phrase shorn scrotum at one point. Yeah, but like that whole monologue is hilarious. Yeah.
And the female lead's Elizabeth, what's her name?
Berkeley. Yeah.
Elizabeth Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
She was a big deal then, too.
Huge deal. Yeah. Because of the Hugh Grant stuff.
She was in Hugh Grant movies?
She, John, okay.
Was she married to Hugh Grant when he did
this is like 90s
the prostitute
talk.
Thing?
They were dating. Oh. And I'm not sure exactly. I think she had been a model, maybe. But yeah, she really rose to like prominence and became recognizable because she was the woman that Hugh Grant cheated on
with it was a transgendered prostitute.
Was it? I don't remember if that was. I don't know.
I see
that might be true.
Had a you bit know, of a affair. When
do you remember his first public interview? Was with Jay Leno.
Shut up, dude.
Yeah, because Leno's first question, I'll never forget this. So, what were you thinking? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what he said, and people I bet went fucking wild.
What the hell were you thinking? Yeah.
And he said, well, I have to be, I had a bit of cocaine, I guess. I had a bit of drugs.
I mean, who hasn't had cocaine, but yeah. Yeah.
We're going to do a podcast soon where it's just Colin interviewing people as Jay Leno. Jay Leno in different universes. Jesus Christ. Because I can tell he wants to do it. That's the thing. I can see that he's like, he gets in the fucking groove and he doesn't want to let it go.
So I'm here with King Theoden. He's been a bit sleepy for the last couple of years. Theoden, you need a cup of coffee?
Why was Jay Leno ever popular? Anyway, that's all I have to say about everything. God, we went on a tangent. I don't know. It's fun to talk to Colin. We don't do this.
Yeah, anymore. This is good. This is a good time. Yeah, yeah.
Mission Impossible is a movie. If you want to see it, just go watch it.
You should
it.
Go see it.
You Tom Cruise does the wildest shit a human can do. The fact he is not dead is just mind-blowing.
Yeah. And again, it's for all the silliness of this episode, it's a genuinely beautiful movie. Again, it makes action aesthetically satisfying, which is cool. Yeah.
Agreed. All right. That's it. Thanks for checking out. Uh-oh. You done? I thought you were about to sneeze. Are we signing off? Until next time, brave travelers. Oh, for the Hop Ones podcast. My name is John.
My name is Colin.
All right, buddy. I'll see you later.
Okay.